Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, where do we start?
Well, I think we have to start by talking about women.
Yeah, okay, but what about the politics?
I think it has been a great week for women in politics.
It was, absolutely.
Start in California.
Okay, we can start in California. For the first time in Republican Party history, not only do they have a female candidate for governor, but a female candidate for the Senate.
Of course, the Democrats have done that before.
They have.
And the Democrats currently have two women senators from California.
One of three states. What are the other two states?
That would be Washington State and Maine.
That's correct.
The point here is that the Republicans have now gotten on the bandwagon and nominated two women, one for governor, Meg Whitman, who spent $80 million largely up
71 of her own, out of her own pocket.
And $9 million from some other people who had nothing better to do with their money than give it to Meg Whitman. Right. And also Carly Fiorina, who got, with a much, much smaller price tag, this is a good businesswoman, she got her nomination for the United States Senate for a mere, what, $10 million?
And she also won big. I mean, we kept talking about
she
all
clobbered.
Year long that
she
Tom
ruled.
Campbell and she were kind of like running neck and neck, and polls that would show that Tom Campbell would be stronger in November against Barbara Boxer. But Fiorina won overwhelmingly, I think, 58% of the vote in a three-way field.
And interestingly, she was sharing some of the more conservative vote, Tom Campbell being something of a liberal moderate Republican. Carly Fiorina was sharing the conservative Republican primary vote with a challenger, a Chuck DeVore from the state assembly, who never had enough money to compete, really, but who was clearly the favorite of the most conservative, especially the social conservative.
And yet there was significant Tea Party support for Fiorina. Sarah Palin weighed in. Sarah Palin also had a very good day picking winners in, for example, Carly Fiorina in California.
Although she was not involved with Meg Whitman.
No, she stayed out of that race.
And she had a big day in respect to Nevada and also South Carolina. And we're going to get to those states. But while we're still in California, your best gut right now, Carly Fiorina is taking on Barbara Boxer, a three-term senator. Meg Whitman's taking on Jerry Brown, who incredibly is coming back almost, 35 years after he was first elected
governor. A chance
governor.
Of becoming not only the youngest governor and the oldest governor in California history.
All right. And right now in the polls, both Whitman and Fiorina running a little bit behind those two Democrats, Boxer, the incumbent, and Brown, who is, if not incumbent, at least ancient.
Well, here's the problem. Meg Whitman, for the longest time, seemed to have a lead. And what happened during the primaries is that Steve Poizner was trying to pull her over further to the right.
Especially he was her conservative.
She was a conservative.
And he had quite a bit of money of his own.
He had $25 million, right? $25 million of his own money. But he also was far more conservative, and he was trying to pull her on, certainly like illegal immigration, saying, I support the Arizona law and you don't, and I'm really more of a conservative than you are. And so she started inching more and more to the right. And by doing that, it helped her regain the lead, which turned out to be sizable in the Republican primary. But in doing that, it has the potential of turning off centrist moderates in California. That could hurt her in November.
It's conceivable that she would have been better off letting Steve Poizner take a little bit of her margin away in the primary, but not moving so far as she did on the immigration issue. She's going to have to retrack on that.
Yeah, I but think sometimes you listen to either conservatives on the right or liberals on the left. For example, if Blanche Lincoln had let Bill Halter go on and on and on about what a corporatist she was, she probably not would have survived that runoff. So she did have to answer back, and I suspect Meg Whitman had to answer back Poizner. But again, in doing so, she may have hurt her chances in November. But who knows? They have tons of money. She spent $80 million just
unlimited, really.
Just to win the Republican nomination.
Spend what it takes. So we assume she will spend overall, primary and general, at least $150 million, smashing all previous records.
Was that Bloomberg?
Corzine spent the most winning a seat in the Senate or a governorship.
And Bloomberg, of course.
But Bloomberg, of course, for mayor, has broken all records. But I think her spending is going to be between $150 and $200 million to win a governorship, which she has not yet won. And, of course, if she wins, then she has to govern California. Congratulations. Pop the champagne.
That's far more money than
$19 billion debt.
I think that's far more money than the Democratic candidate for Senate in South Carolina spent to win that primary.
Oh, you're talking here about Alvin Green. We're going to get to Alvin Green, the star of this week's broadcast.
What was that?
Politician of the week, got to be Alvin Green. We're coming back to him.
Okay.
But first, let's talk about a couple of other women candidates endorsed by Sarah Palin who did rather well this week.
The best, biggest story, of course, is Nikki Haley in South Carolina. Once upon a time, an unknown state representative against three top flight male candidates.
Absolutely. The
state
lieutenant governor,
state
attorney,
attorney
general,
general,
and a congressman.
Right, exactly. So she was always thought to be an asterisk in that race. She did get an early endorsement from Jenny Sanford, and that seemed to put her at least in the minds of many folks. And then she got the endorsements of Mitt Romney and later Sarah Palin, which gave her even more attention. But as she got more attention, I suspect that the male power structure felt threatened, because suddenly these two men out of nowhere came up with this intimate physical relationship with her.
One was not out of nowhere. One was a blogger who had known her.
They both knew her.
Quite well. Right. And had many, many emails he could point to.
And phone calls.
But no evidence of an illicit or improper kind of relationship.
But that only came out when she took the lead the polls.
When she went ahead, suddenly everybody noticed that she was a woman and said, oh, I slept with her. Right. No, there was something very suspicious about the timing. Also something very suspicious about the second accuser, who had to drop out of the campaign staff of one of her rivals, Andre Bauer.
Lieutenant Governor Bauer, right.
Before he made his accusation. So one can put whatever frame around that
And if that was supposed to hurt her, matter of fact, exactly. She came just short of winning the nomination outright. She came with 49%+. She needed 50%+. To win outright. So now she goes into a June 22nd runoff with Congressman Gresham Barrett,
who has the backing of Dick Cheney and the backing of some other elements of the establishment, but only got about, 22%?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very hard to see him overtaking her with her momentum at this point. She's practically Joan of Arc.
Now, there is pressure on him to get out of the race. As a matter of fact, if you listen to national Republicans the night of the primary, they were talking about the next governor, Nikki Haley. Barrett, however, is now on television with a new aunt, so obviously he's not going to go away quietly.
And he's hoping that in some way, shape, or form, all of this attention to Nikki Haley could still blow up in her face, and in some way or another, he could be the beneficiary of that.
Before you go away from Nikki Haley, I just want to say one thing, that even though she's a fresh face, she does not have the baggage or the long political career of her three Republican rivals. She does have the support of the so-called Mark Sanford machine. I don't know what that means anymore.
Well, Jenny Sanford.
But yes,
that's what it means.
But Mark Sanford.
Jenny Sanford was probably the reason Nikki Haley first got attention when she started running for governor.
True, but had he not disappeared to Argentina or the Appalachian Trail, Mark Sanford would have been behind Nikki Haley's campaign. In fact, when the first man came out and talked about the affair he allegedly had with Haley, Mark Sanford vouched for her ethics, which is sort of like Ron Elving.
Vouching for your ethics.
Exactly.
I can imagine. All right. One other thing about South Carolina before we move on. The Republicans nominated for the Senate their incumbent United States Senator Jim DeMint, who is a major rising force in the Republican
National
caucus in the Senate and becoming something of a national figure. Some people are talking about him being on the ticket in 2012. He's probably going to be in pretty good shape in South Carolina this fall, if only because the Democrats, in a bit of a slip-up, did not nominate the former judge and lawmaker who was supposed to be their more or less sacrificial lamb against DeMint this fall. He only got 40% of the vote, and the other 60% went to a juggernaut, heretofore unheard of, named Alvin Green.
Well, unheard of even in his own household.
He was 32 years old, Iraq war vet. It says Iraq
unemployed,
war vet.
Unemployed.
That's his ID.
Right.
Doesn't say unemployed. It just says Iraq war vet.
But he is unemployed.
And people said, hey, there's a nice name. Alvin Green sounds like a good guy. He's an Iraq war vet. They voted for him because they hadn't heard of the other guy either.
Well, the other guy was a former judge, a former state lawmaker.
But not a very prominent fellow.
No, but he has spent several hundred thousand dollars on the campaign already. I mean,
That's where he went wrong.
And he also had a website.
He went wrong by campaigning for the office.
Alvin Green not only didn't have buttons, which disqualifies him in my book, but he didn't even have a website. As a matter of fact, he lives with his mom. Now it turns out that there are felony accusations laid against Mr. Alvin Green.
You know, so all that good news that he got on Tuesday has
right.
turned around on him, and now he's been exposed as being at least charged with showing pornography to a college student.
Which is, you don't think of weird sex stuff going on in South Carolina, but at least now he'll have an occupation associated with his name.
That's nice.
Convict.
That's right. Iraq war veteran, pornographer. Much better to have a profession.
I mean, let's face it. Look, Jim DeMint was going to win no matter whom the Democrats put up, and they just didn't have anybody. But for all the talk that Democrats think that with Vincent Shaheen, the Democratic nominee for governor in South Carolina.
All the talk, Ken? Where have you heard talk that the South Carolina Democrats think they're coming back this year?
On this podcast. Did you just hear me say that? No, I don't know. No. Democrats say that because of the Mark Sanford influence, because of the Nikki Haley allegations, the Republicans, if nothing else, are running under a cloud. And this Shaheen, you're making a face, Ron, and I agree with that face. Matter of fact, I love that face. But the point is, Democrats think they have an opportunity. And if they did, they certainly don't have it with Alvin Green. What's interesting also in the Senate race, Jim Clyburn, the congressman from South Carolina, is among the Democrats who sees something nefarious going on with the Alvin Green nomination. And he said, well, maybe Republicans crossed over and voted for him. I'll tell you why that's not possible, because you either take a Republican ballot when you go in the voting booth or a Democratic ballot, and given the fact that there was so much focus on the Republican nomination for governor, no Republican is going to say, no, no, I'm going to vote in the Democratic primary.
All right, but let's let the listener have that little lobe of paranoia that is so important to all of us. Somebody paid a $10,000
filing fee.
Right. And it makes no sense that Alvin Green would have had such money all in one place at all at one time and have spent it that way.
I agree. Right.
So there is a question mark over all of this, and we'll see. Stay tuned. The podcast will stay on top of this story.
One more thing about South Carolina before we leave. Bob Inglis, a conservative member of Congress from, I believe, the 4th Congressional District. Who years ago ran against Fritz Hollings as a right-wing conservative.
Oh, he was part of the Newt Gingrich movement in the mid-90s.
But returning to Congress, he suddenly became a rhino because he voted for the bank bailout in 2008. That's not good enough for the conservatives, and he looks like he's going to lose the runoff on June 27th.
Well, he got a very poor vote, under 30%, nowhere near the half that he would have needed to be nominated. And somebody else got almost 40, Trey Gowdy.
Another thing to point out is in the 1st Congressional District, where the very famous Henry Brown is retiring.
Roll of the drums.
An interesting vision here. The son of Strom Thurmond is running against Tim Scott. And if Tim Scott wins the June 22nd Republican runoff in South Carolina, he will be the 4th black Republican to serve in the House in history.
That's assuming, of course, he wins in November. But
yeah,
we
it's
do
a solidly
assume,
Republican
solid Republican
district.
They'll vote for Tim Scott.
And he did much better. As a matter of fact, the primary included Strom Thurmond's son and Carol Campbell's son. And yet,
Carol Campbell is a well-remembered, now deceased, former governor from South Carolina.
And Strom Thurmond, of course, being the long-term senator, right? And yet Tim Scott finished a strong first in that primary, but again, not enough to win outright.
Yeah, we've been talking about South Carolina, and we've been talking about how Sarah Palin's endorsement for Nikki Haley appears to have been very helpful to her in that state, especially at the moment of those sexual
allegations.
She also
had Tea Party support.
She also had support outright from the Tea Party, and the Tea Party is crowing primarily about the candidate they put over the top without Sarah Palin's explicit help in Nevada.
Well, that's what's interesting, too, is because not too long ago, Sharron Angle was an asterisk in the battle for the Senate race in Nevada. Sue Loudon, former state party chair,
former state legislator, former Miss New Jersey,
was the establishment choice. Now, she had some chicken problems, as you well recall.
She said we could probably solve our health care problems if people would just barter with their doctors like they used to, offering a chicken for a checkup.
So she rapidly fell in the polls.
Precipitously.
And Sharron Angle, whose positions on many issues are quite
unusual. She's in favor of bringing radioactive waste to Nevada.
Well, no, Harry Reid's already there.
She does not think Medicare and Social Security are programs that should go forward.
Right. She thinks the phasing out of Social Security, not a very popular position. But this is kind of reminds me of what happened with Rand Paul in Kentucky. You take somebody who excites the base, will excite the Tea Party base, but ultimately when you have to deal with a general election electorate that may be a little bit outside the mainstream.
So the Tea Party got its woman in Nevada.
Its candidate.
And as you're suggesting, Harry Reid is actually very pleased about this. The candidate he seemed to be most worried about was Sue Loudon, and the candidate he was second most worried about was Danny Tarkanian, son of the basketball coach, who finished third in this primary. They got the opponent they prayed for in Sharron Angle, and they now think that they have a chance to rescue the single least popular Democratic Senate incumbent in the country, Harry Reid, the majority leader.
Well, first of all, always be careful what you wish for. Remember, you remember, Ron, that Democrats were wishing for Ronald Reagan as the Republican nominee for president, not only in 1980, but also the Republican nominee for governor against Pat Brown in 66. Oh, that actor. I love to run against
him. Laugh.
Now, comparing Sharron Angle to Ronald Reagan is a little bit of a stretch.
Maybe.
But we said this from the beginning. Yes, it's true that polls show that any Republican that Harry Reid ran against would trounce Harry Reid. But when you come to the real Republican, to the reality of who that Republican is, although I should say, though, that I think the Republicans got a break in the gubernatorial race because Jim Gibbons was absolute the worst.
He was more radioactive than that stuff they were taking to Yucca Mountain.
If you look at a picture of Yucca in the dictionary,
you see a picture of Jim Gibbons.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so he lost badly to former federal judge Brian Sandoval,
who looks like a very good candidate.
Who is a strong candidate. And running against Harry Reid's son, Rory Reid. Now, that could come back and bite the Democrats as well. Do you want
a
Reid, and Weep ticket in Nevada? So I think, you know, don't count Sharron Angle out yet. But I agree with the conventional wisdom in that Harry Reid did get a little break on Tuesday's primary.
All right. Now we've managed to get this deep into the podcast without talking about the one race that most people led with all week long in the news. And that was the somewhat surprising defeat of the challenge to Blanche Lincoln, the incumbent in Arkansas. Everyone had already thrown a lot of dirt on Blanche Lincoln and said, she's done, she's finished, she didn't win in the first round in May. Here she is in the runoff, she's going to lose the runoff. But Bill Halter, the lieutenant governor, turned out to be the guy with dirt on his face.
Well, I think if anybody has egg on his face, it's organized labor and perhaps the progressive left slash netroots, because they backed Bill Halter to the hilt.
$10 million.
$10 million. And, you know, we kept talking about this anti-incumbency that's out there. And if any incumbent was going to go down on Tuesday, it was going to be Blanche Lincoln. She was trailing in the polls, and it's something to be said about Arkansas polls.
Not by
polls.
Much, though.
No, but trailing.
And polling in a runoff has got to be even more tenuous than most polling, because you've got a tiny little turnout, and the polls never know whether or not they're interviewing someone who's going to vote in the turnout.
True, but in the original primary, she had anywhere between a 7 and 9% lead in the polls, and she only won by 2. So the Arkansas polling leaves much to be desired. But again, given the excitement on the left, the antipathy they had for Blanche Lincoln, I was surprised that Halter lost. Now, a lot of Democrats were saying at the end, the good thing about Bill Halter is that he'd be stronger in November. He won't have the Washington baggage.
There was a flaw in the vessel here, too. I don't think Bill Halter was very convincing as a champion of the downtrodden. I don't think he was very convincing as a champion of MoveOn.org or the unions. He just looked like a guy who thought he'd like to be in the United States Senate and sought an opportunity to ride this wave of anti-incumbency and
anti-Lincoln
anger that was brought to him by these outside influence groups that wanted him to be their stalking horse.
Well, if there is a champion in all this, it may be Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton campaign gave a very strong endorsement of Blanche Lincoln, campaigned for her hard, and also he did a similar thing in Pennsylvania 12, where he campaigned
Mark
Critz.
Yeah.
So you have a combination of Bill Clinton in Arkansas for Blanche Lincoln. You also have her with a very effective TV commercial saying, I am running against those Washington unions. Now, you don't hear many Democrats saying that, let alone Democratic incumbents.
And not alone meaning it.
So, I mean, I still think that if I had to bet, I would say John Bozeman, the Republican, wins in November. But again, I was surprised that Blanche Lincoln pulled it out, and it was pretty convincing.
One more thing to say about California is that the voters there passed Proposition 14. Mm. This is going to create a different system, unless it's thrown out by the courts, for nominating candidates for the final election in November. Instead of taking the top Republican and running them against the top Democrat, everyone's
and third
going
party, top third
and
party,
third
guys,
party
right?
candidates who still can run in November. All candidates of all stripes and all allegiances or no allegiances will run in one big, sometimes they call it jungle primary, right. And the top two finishers, regardless of affiliation, go on to the November test. Why are people in California, well, I know why the people in the parties don't like it, because they're largely losing control of the process, but why are the people in California who are for this so convinced that this is going to be a help in dealing with their terrible budget problems?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, because I'm not convinced that does work, because for all we know, anybody who enters this new system in California and it becomes effective 2011, if you spend the most money or you're a famous actor like Arnold Schwarzenegger, those are the kind of candidates who could win. Meg Whitman with $80 million, or anybody with a bunch of
gazillion dollars. Meg Whitman wouldn't need to be a Republican anymore.
No, exactly right. I mean, you could also make the case that maybe Tom Campbell would do better in something like this, because he may have the views that a majority of the electorate support.
So he could have Democrats and independents voting for him in the first round.
Which did him no good in the past when running as a Republican,
right? Right. So he would not have to choose between parties and make that fateful choice that is the end of so many political careers. But the idea is that if you created a legislature and a congressional delegation and a statewide power structure where people were not tightly identified with a party, they might be able to work with each other.
It will change politics in California. And of course, as we know, trends that we see beginning in California do have a propensity of
affecting all of California
and spreading to the rest of the country. So we'll see. But before we go, I want to say one thing. We're talking about the Day of the Woman. And for the most part, we've been talking about Republican women. But in Iowa, Roxanne Conlin won the Senate nomination to run against incumbent Republican Chuck Grassley.
Does she have a chance of beating Chuck Grassley?
Well, Grassley's been around a long time in the Senate since 80. He's been a state legislature since the 1950s. There is some dissatisfaction with Grassley. I don't think she beats him, but I should also point that Iowa has never sent a woman to the House or Senate. It'd be something to watch. Also in Maine, Elizabeth Mitchell, the state Senate majority leader who ran against Bill Cohn back in 1984 for the Senate, has resurfaced as a statewide candidate. She won the Democratic nomination for governor, and the Tea Party's choice choice for governor of Maine won that primary on the Republican side. So between a veteran Democrat and a Tea Party Republican, it's a possibility that you could have once again an independent candidate winning in Maine, which has happened twice in the last 25, 30 years.
Elizabeth Mitchell, any relation to George?
None.
And that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. I feel like a grizzly bear. Yeah, I feel like a grizzly bear.